Artist Kara Walker spent her teenage years in Atlanta after her father, the artist and professor Larry Walker, got a job at Georgia State University. Her family lived in Stone Mountain, home of the famous and controversial Confederate memorial carving. That carving, the world's largest bas-relief sculpture, inspired Kara's own monumental piece, The Jubilant Martyrs of Obsolescence and Ruin. It was recently acquired by the High Museum of Art. Even if you're not familiar with her name, you may be familiar with Kara Walker's work. She's the MacArthur-winning artist behind the enormous Sphinx made of sugar that was once housed in a Brooklyn warehouse. I recently spoke with Kara about her career, starting with the new High Museum acquisition, which, like most of her work, has a very long title.
I think I have a tendency towards long titles that kind of overshoot the point a little bit, but I'm always looking for something that's more poetic than dogmatic. In this case, I because I was concentrating on Stone Mountain or some of the ideas around Stone Mountain, I really thought that it needed to be to express a kind of enthusiasm that went into the creation of that monumental carving.
I was so shocked in reading the background about what you experienced when you moved here from California as a 13-year-old girl. I am from Chicago. I moved down here when I was an adult, but I didn't realize that sort of racism and nastiness was as overt as it was in the late 60s.
Yeah, it's overt. And I think, you know, what was interesting, or I don't know, it was interesting in retrospect and sort of annoying and irritating and frightening as a child, or young adult, is that, you know, my experience also dovetailed with puberty in high school and the sort of nastiness of kids at that age anyway. But then there's a sort of added layer that was quite mysterious to me in a way of the byproducts and effects of long-standing, let's call them traditions, you know, not because it feels too shorthandy to just sort of say, like, you know, people said racist things. Like, that's true, but also people held on to beliefs that were foreign to me. Even as a, you know, young Black woman, I really had a different sort of maybe experience or set of ideas about myself coming from a different place. And so I felt very alien in this environment that seemed kind of locked in a kind of battle with past and with the present and with, you know, current realities. And so
I wonder how different it might have been if your parents had moved into the city rather than Stone Mountain. I mean, that really
I wondered that too, but it didn't happen. So I got an experience, yeah, as my mom likes to sort of spin it, you know.
And it fueled your art.
Well, I think I had art as a part of my background early on, and I think that helped me be able, you know, having art was a way of processing, you know, living a life and having experiences that I couldn't quite understand.
For people unfamiliar with your work, you use silhouettes, and the Jubilant Martyrs shows about a dozen scenes. Would you please describe some of them?
Well, it is all cut from large sheets of black paper, and I began with a kind of a riff on the three horsemen who appear on Stone Mountain, carved on the side, Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. They are not true or well-studied portraits or portrayals of the men on horseback, but I did find it very curious that one of the attributes of the carving on Stone Mountain is that it's sort of unfinished and the horses have no legs and they appear to be sort of disappearing or being swallowed up by the mountain or by water or some unseen force. So there's some central horse figures. There's a figure that is being hung. There are figures that have gross, stereotypical sort of Negro features, so-called, and there are figures that are meant to conjure up a kind of the ideal of the lost cause, the soldier with the broken sword, the monumental figure on top of a heap of bodies. I think one of the riffs or one of the motifs or one of the jokes that sort of recurs in the work is something about horses and mules. And so there are a couple of people in a pantomime horse suit also.
Since you've been in the public eye, there have been many conversations about your work. And one quote that gets thrown around a lot from art critics is that the work is satirical, showing the ridiculousness of wholesome depictions of the antebellum South. If that's what you would call it, if that's what you, the artist, would call it, what draws you to satire?
I mean, satire is fine as a word, but it's not exactly what I think that I'm doing. In fact, I think that I'm an accidental satirist.
now there's the title of your autobiography.
I think that as a young, in graduate school, and when I really started thinking about what was important to me, I also started thinking about the limitations that were sort of presented to me as a Black woman American artist, and some of those limitations have been, you know, handed down from generations of oppression and neglect, and then some of it was also handed down by a generation or two of Black arts movements, you know, sort of reclaiming of the creative space for people just like me. So that, in a funny way, I'm really deviating from your question. In a funny way, I felt as a painter or printmaker sort of compelled to go in and go hard on the idea of reclaiming history and also questioning that history that must be reclaimed. And somehow I had these sort of, it's almost like two competing interests from outside of me battling for primacy as the sort of like overarching conceptual conceit of my work. And then there's also me who's kind of like, I don't really want to be in this fight. So it's sort of like those are the three things that are at work. And it winds up being quite funny.
It all works.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes talking with Carol Walker. Her work, The Jubilant Martyrs of Obsolescence and Ruin, has been acquired by the High Museum of Art for the permanent collection. A Subtlety or the Marvelous Sugar Baby was your first public art piece, and it was inside the Domino Sugar Refining Plant in New York. How did thinking about historical narratives of sugar lead to the sugar baby, which was enormous?
Yeah.
I mean, not just in its size, the impact.
Yeah, that was a lot of work in a short period of time. I mean, a lot of thinking work, because, I was thinking about sugar, and sugar has got a history much longer than the one that we think of, and I kind of wanted to embrace all of it. You know, I wanted to have, you know, the idea of these sugar sculptures that were present in, you know, the courts of medieval kings. And also I wanted to talk about the transatlantic slave trade and also the cultivation of sugar and also, you know, sugar's impact on, you know, contemporary or modern history and contemporary society. So it kind of had to be monumental. Also, the space was huge, and I wanted to, you know, really think about the problems of public art, which generally the problem, one of the problems that I think artists encounter and that the public encounters is a kind of disconnect between like conceptual, you know, the conceptual art world, you know, and all of its sort of theories and talkiness, than the idea that art for the public should also be pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
It should elicit wonder. And so
that's, you know, why you went with your camera trying to capture people's responses to Sugar Baby.
Yeah, I think that was, it was fascinating also because, you know, I make things and I want to be an artist making things, but I am also a witness to some extent. And so while that piece was up, I really wanted to be there because there was something cool in town. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like separate from me in a weird way. Like I wasn't thinking, oh, I made this. I was thinking, God, there's this awesome thing that happened.
Well, to tell us
it's
about
such an anomaly.
The dimensions.
It was 75 feet long by about 35 feet high at its tallest point. And, you know, it's a sphinx-like figure that's got mammy features and breasts and a butt and a vagina and sort of crouch in this odd position that's both subservient and also very majestic and upright, and it's covered with 40 tons of sugar thereabouts.
Astonishing.
So it was quite a lot of, you know, it was a lot of effort by, you know, like a very concentrated, amazing group of facilitators really help put that together.
How do you feel about the ephemeral aspect of art? I mean, when I think of what you put into that and the size and impact of it, I think, well, wouldn't you like generations, future generations to experience this? No,
it's always ephemeral, you know. I don't know. I think that, you know, that piece in particular was really designed to live in this moment, you know, prior to the destruction of something that I thought was, you know, quite tragic in a way, that you know, the forces of capitalism ruined all of these bodies and all of these lives for centuries of slavery, and then, you know, all for naught, all for what, you know? So, and in some way, in some tragic way, it could only live for a moment for those sort of lost souls or something. I mean, you know, if I'm not satirizing things, I'm just a downer. So I'd be rather.
Do you still have the hand from this?
Yeah. The hand of the Sphinx, the hand that was configured into a fig sign, which is kind of a rude gesture, is currently on view in Hydra in Greece in a small art space called the Slaughterhouse, which was a former slaughterhouse. And it's a very tiny jewel box space that the hand just fits within, and it has a fresh coating of sugar.
Hmm.
It's a strange place for it to end up, but it feels very right somehow, because I did want in some way to have a relic.
And there it is, in the land of relics.
Exactly, yeah.
We spoke with your dad last year when he was awarded the Atlanta Contemporary's Nexus Award.
That's right, yeah.
Has his work inspired your own in any way?
Well, you know, my dad is an amazing educator and artist, and one of the gifts that he gave me, which I sometimes forget to appreciate and sometimes remember full on, is just the gift of valuing creativity. You know, sort of like making my own legend as I speak, because I've said this a number of times, but, you know, he put the chalk in my hands. You know, he, you know, sort of nurtured a sense of my own being and my own capacity to sort of belong to myself in a way in the making of something. So I could sit sort of for hours and draw or try and make things, or like I was always trying to make houses out of cardboard, which always fell apart. Or, you know, I was always kind of invested in that in a way that Well, I say it was valued. It was also kind of, you know, lauded a little bit, which doesn't hurt when you're small.
No, and maybe then this offsets your memories of their moving you to Stone Mountain. Kara, do you think the public is more accepting of your work now?
To some extent, we'll see. I'm working on a show now. I think that there's more room in a broader a collection of voices than maybe when I first started out, or even if I think about the sorts of arguments that artists of color have had to face over the last, you know, in the 20th century, there has in the past been, you know, a pretty broad array of types of responses to my work. Mm-hmm. And so while, you know, sometimes I encounter a kind of critical response that seems hellishly cruel, and I think that my work also elicits some of that because it comes from sometimes quite dark ideas or dark realities or dark sentiments. And so my treatment, which is somewhat, you know, sometimes satirical and sometimes that satire masks a kind of fatalism, doesn't go over well.
Well, when your heritage is slavery, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, how can you not have that right. perspective?
Well, you can have that perspective, but, you know, I think that sometimes I come off as a bit blasé or a bit slap in the face because there is something kind of odd and cruel about, you know, art, the making of art, because it doesn't solve the problems. You know, it just sort of presents the image or an image that's reflected from a number of different sources, or sometimes it presents a kind of internal confusion that is sort of the result of trying to process history.
Yeah, and those images and that art, it may not solve the problems, but it can lead to the conversations which are essential for finding resolutions or at least moving toward understanding. Mm-hmm. Kara, it has really been a privilege to talk with you, and I admire your work tremendously.
Well, thank you. It was really a treat to talk to you as well.